warned us about. Maybe it wasn't Faye, but she didn't say that. But the main thing she warned us about was that if he bites you, he takes over your body. I have the distinct impression, though I don't remember why, if it takes you over, your death is inevitable. Something had bitten Dennis, I thought, and he had killed Anna and then himself. I remember the tight feeling in my head just before I'd gotten my jaws around that rabbit. I have a limited and unpredictable resistance to magic. Maybe this was one of those kinds of magic that didn't affect me. I felt a chill of retroactive relief at not being some sort of mind slave to the jackrabbit smoke beast who had bitten me. "What does it want?" I asked. Aiden shook his head. "That's all I know about it, other than that it was dangerous enough that Tilly warned me to stay away. I'll ask Tilly what she knows, but you might also ask Luth's son if he knows anything. It was imprisoned in a territory of Underhill that his family controlled."
"Did she release it on purpose?" I asked. Aiden shrugged.
"I don't know."
He looked at me.
"It isn't out of the question."
Chapter 4
"5 in the morning is a crummy time for an all-hands meeting," said Honey briskly as she came in the door. "Mercy wanted it to be at 3 in the morning," said Aiden. "But Adam told her that he needed everyone functional."
He was curled up on one of the living room couches and wrapped in a blanket. He didn't normally feel the cold, but whatever Wolf had done to him was still lingering. I was pretty sure I was right that if Wolf had done something permanent, he would have bragged about it. I didn't think Wolf had enough power to undo something Underhill had created, but I was less sure of that today than I would have been before last night. The wolves had given the blanket curious looks, but no one had asked Aiden about it. At his words, though, the stragglers who were lingering in the living room, mostly hovering over too-hot-to-drink coffee they'd gotten from the pot in the kitchen, directed appalled gazes at me. I hadn't been serious about 3 a.m., but at 2 in the morning, Adam had been on the phone, on the internet, or pacing for hours and hadn't seemed likely to sleep anytime soon. Aiden, who had been seriously spooked by the creature he thought might be wandering around our home and by having his magic quenched so thoroughly, had kept me company as I made cookies and watched Adam pace until I declared enough and went to bed myself. With the wee hour light peeking into the windows, the pack accused me of torturing them with their sleep-deprived eyes, if not words. I shrugged. They didn't need to know how wound up Adam had been about the intrusion of another pack into our territory. And his stress was not lessened by the trouble that he had characterized as lack of control over the wolf, but as Wolf seemed to think was something different. Adam would show them what he wanted them to see, what they needed to see, their alpha, strong and resolute. So instead of explaining, I told them, "Adam said that it wasn't anything that couldn't wait for the morning. It had to be early morning so that we could get the whole pack here. You can blame Aurelie, who has to be at the high school by 7 at the latest. Adam is upstairs if you want to head to the meeting room. He'll start as soon as everyone gets here."
"Do you know what this is about?" asked Ben.
He took a sip of his coffee and then exploded into expletives that had a couple of the wolves taking out their phones to look up a few of the words he used. He was British, our Ben, and had the foulest mouth I'd ever heard. One didn't, I was pretty sure, have a lot to do with the other, but both of them occasionally required translations. "We are holding a meeting," I pointed out to him when he'd calmed down enough to listen, "so we don't have to repeat the same stuff over and over as new people come in." Sherwood Post opened the door on the end of my sentence with a steaming Starbucks venti cup in one hand.
"Starbucks is open?" asked Luke. "I could have gotten Starbucks?"
"Hey," I said, "don't diss my coffee."
"How's Pirate?" asked Honey.
Pirate was the one-eyed kitten that Sherwood had rescued. There had been a point at which we had all been certain the kitten wouldn't make it. But as of last week, he'd been freed from the vet's tender care. Sherwood nodded at Honey, which meant that Pirate was fine. Then he looked at me and asked,
"What's up?"
"A meeting," I told him, "so I don't have to repeat myself over and over." Ben snorted a laugh.
Sherwood looked like a lumberjack in his red flannel shirt and khaki pants. He wore the peg leg today, so he was probably headed to work after this. The foot prosthetic was more expensive, and he didn't like to risk it. He'd just gotten a new prosthetic that looked like a modern artist decided to blend the idea of a foot with a spring. It was more useful and stronger than either of the other two, but he wasn't comfortable in it yet, so he only wore it at home or at the gym. No, he hadn't told me all of that. He still didn't talk much, but the whole damn pack gossiped about him like a bunch of fond mamas. His facility with magic, when his wolf took over, had resulted in a betting pool about the real identity of our amnesiac packmate. I had instituted a $1 limit per bet. Winners split the pot. It currently stood at $187.29. There was, I had learned from the entries, an entire folklore about old wolves and their deeds that I had been unaware of. Being a history major, I was more than a little grumpy that no one had told me all those stories, but I was learning. I kept the betting book, and before I would write down the name, I made the wolf doing the betting tell me about their candidate for the position. Maybe sometime I'd record all the stories I learned. I couldn't publish them since a lot of them demonstrated just how dangerous werewolves were, and we were currently trying to soft-pedal that for the humans we lived among, so they didn't decide that the only good werewolf was a dead werewolf. But still, someone should write them down. The choices for Sherwood's real identity weren't limited to werewolf legends, though. Five people had put their money on Robin Hood. If they had been older wolves, I would have been excited. But four of them were from the current generation, and the other was, I think, joking. Still, Sherwood Post to Sherwood Forest made a certain amount of symbolic sense. And everyone knew that Robin Hood had lived in Sherwood Forest. So had Little John and Allan a Dale, Friar Tuck, and Will Scarlet. Little John had gotten $2. Allan a Dale and Will Scarlet, $1 each. No one had put money on Friar Tuck. Our Sherwood just didn't look like the friar type. As Kelly had pointed out when he handed me his dollar for Robin Hood, Bran seldom did things without reason. When I told him the story I'd had from both Sherwood and Bran, that he'd picked the name because Bran had had a book by Sherwood Anderson and the treatise on manners by Emily Post on his desk, Kelly had snorted.
"Please," he said. "Everyone knows that Bran keeps his books in his bookshelves and not on his desk unless he is actively reading. We had that from several different sources. Also, no one has ever seen Bran read Sherwood Anderson before or since that day."
I blinked at him. Apparently, there had been a lot more serious investigation into Sherwood than I'd been aware of. Misreading my expression, Kelly backtracked a little.
"Elliot knows a couple of wolves from the Morocco's pack. Luke knows a few more."
"Might be right," I said. "I don't remember." Most of what I remembered about Bran's study had to do with keeping my eyes down and pretending I was sorry, or mystified if the evidence against me wasn't strong, for whatever it was Bran was mad at me about. I hadn't been paying attention to whether he had books on his desk. Before I took his dollar, though, I told Kelly, "You should know that historians are not sure that Robin Hood was a real person, or if he was, if he was as significant a figure as the stories about him make it appear." Kelly shoved the dollar into my hand and pointed to where three other names were behind Robin Hood on my notebook page.
"And maybe he was a werewolf," he said.
When someone asked Sherwood directly about the Robin Hood identity, he hunted me down and asked to see the betting book. Sherwood put a dollar down on Robin Hood himself and another dollar on William Shakespeare.
"I can shoot arrows," he'd said, "but I'd rather have been a poet."
I still wasn't sure how to take that. Sherwood certainly had given no sign of wanting to be good with words. On the other hand, poets don't need to use a lot of words to get their point across, even if Shakespeare had. This morning, our mysterious Sherwood gave me a nod.
"Upstairs?"
"Yes," I said. He nodded again, this time at all the wolves gathered in the living room, raised his cup to me, and then headed up. After milling around a little more than they had been, the rest of the wolves in the living room followed him. Still wrapped in a blanket, Aiden tagged along behind.
Adam had asked him to attend the meeting, too. Daryl and Arielle came in a few minutes later. Arielle brushed past me and up the stairs. She pretended not to notice me, and I was pretty sure it wasn't embarrassment or regret or anything like that driving her. She was still mad at me. Daryl gave me an apologetic shrug, because he knew she was still mad at me too, and followed her up. Warren was the last one to arrive. "Everyone else is here," I told him, "but you have 15 minutes before the meeting starts." Something struck me suddenly. "You know, this is the most punctual group of any I've ever seen."
"Adam," Warren said, taking off his hat and tapping it against his thigh, "appreciates promptness. He explained that by holding meetings every 4 hours until the whole pack managed not to be late. It took 2 days and nearly resulted in Paul's death when he was late for the next to last meeting."
Paul had died by other means. We both sucked in a breath before I said, "I could see that. Punctuality was never really his thing. It is yours. Usually you aren't the last to arrive." Warren was wearing jeans and boots, as he had since I met him. But his jeans now fit with an edge that said designer, and his shirt was a polo that clung to the muscles of his shoulders. His clothes had been getting an upgrade lately. In well-fitted, flattering colored clothing, Warren looked pretty good, except for the drawn face and circles under his eyes that were due to more than a single early morning meeting.
"I would have been here sooner, except the case I've been working has me pinched for time," he explained. "It's a rough one."
"A case for Kyle?" I asked.
"Yeah,"
he answered, and there was a little smile on his tired face as he started for the meeting room.
"For Kyle."
Kyle was his boyfriend, though that didn't quite encompass what they were to each other. They hadn't taken the final step, the human final step of getting married, but Adam had told me that they were mates. I couldn't read the pack bonds that well, but I trusted that Adam could. Kyle was very human and a divorce lawyer, and was more than likely responsible for Warren's wardrobe's improvement. Warren worked for him as a licensed investigator who doubled his protection and intimidation where needed. I've always heard it said that it wasn't wise for people who were involved romantically to work together, especially when one of them worked for the other. But it seemed to be a good thing between Warren and Kyle. I didn't ask Warren what Kyle had him doing. Kyle didn't believe in gossiping about clients. If there was something they needed from the pack, I'd hear about it. If not, it might show up in the nightly news. Warren paused on his way up the stairs and gave me a long look. Then he walked back over, wrapped his arms around me, and kissed the top of my head. He was tall, made of whipcord and rawhide, my foster father would have said. He smelled like himself, and a little like a new cologne or a body wash. I sank into the uncomplicated embrace. I hadn't realized how much I needed a hug.
"Heard about Arielle," Warren told me when I finally stepped away. "That woman is going to get herself killed trying to protect Christy from things she don't need protecting from."
"Truthfully," I told him, "I'm more worried about Wolf." I told him about my new stalker in as few words as I could manage. Warren knew Wolf, so that cut down on unneeded explanations.
"A hobby, eh?"
he said, the words casual enough, but there was a harsh edge to his voice. "That's what he said," I agreed.
"That kind of hobby could get a vampire taken out of this world. You say he was immune to Aiden's fire?"
"Yes," I said, "and he was able to stop Aiden from being able to use his magic, and he can come into our house. When Ogden brought him here the night of the zombies, I don't know that he was invited in, Warren. I think he just came." Warren's mouth tightened, but what he said was,
"Well, don't that beat all. Guess you should have a conversation about him with Stefan."
"That's the plan," I agreed. "I have a call in to him, but I expect that he won't call now until tonight. We should go up so Adam can start the meeting." The door to the meeting room was shut, and Jesse, waiting just outside her bedroom door, flagged us down before we could go in. "What's the meeting about?" she asked.
"Jesse doesn't know?" Warren asked.
Jessie was a smart person, I told him. She came in and went to bed last night, so she didn't hear about how we found a nasty creature that might be some sort of boogeyman for the Fae and another nasty creature who has decided to take up stalking me for a hobby. If she'd gotten up earlier this morning, I would have told her all about it then, but now we have to go have a meeting. Jessie raised her eyebrow in interest. Don't worry, though, I said, even though I'd made the whole situation sound funny so she wouldn't be worried. The stalker saved me from the evil nasty. That's just wrong, Jessie said with a grin. I know, right? I shook my head. But that's not why the whole pack got called in, or that's not the only reason why. There's a strange group of wolves nosing into our territory. Warren stiffened.
Invaders?
I shrugged. Looks like. Adam's been on the phone to various old friends all night, putting together a possible list of suspects. He plans on introducing our guests to all of us digitally before we meet them.
Aiden went into the meeting, Jessie said carefully. As a rule, pack meetings were for pack members only.
Aiden was there so he could inform the pack about our escapee from Underhill. Since the pack is the reason you had to shuffle your life around, I told her, I guess that you have a place in our meetings. Come on in if you want to. It will save me having to tell you everything again anyway.
Awesome, she said.
Warren looked at Jessie and gave a solemn shake of his head.
I thought you had more sense. I, for one, have always been grateful for the meetings I have not attended. But if you want to come in with us, I guess I'm a big enough shield that none of the others will try to drive you out.
Except Dad, she said in a small voice.
I narrowed my eyes at the door. He's abject in misery and wallowing in guilt after falling into Christie's. I glanced at Christie's daughter and exchanged trap for
situation. He won't object.
She looked down at herself.
I'm in pajamas.
Go change, I said. We'll wait. I glanced at my watch. You have 3 minutes. She jumped into her room and shut the door.
Why? Warren asked me.
She deserves to be involved, I said. She's making life-defining decisions because of the pack. Likely all three of our current crises will affect her one way or the other.
And because it will drive Arielle to distraction, said Jessie,
emerging from her room now clad in jeans and a shirt sporting a cat with an innocent look and a tail emerging from its mouth, with the words, "Got mouse?" underneath.
Mercy is sneaky that way. Maybe I am too.
She twirled.
Do I look ready for the vengeance games?
I decided that the mouse t-shirt was calculated, though we weren't going to play cat and mouse games with anyone. I was not unaware that Aurelie was going to squirm at the sight of Jessie, but that wasn't the reason I'd included her. I couldn't stand to see her isolated, not this morning anyway. Warren looked at me.
I don't know what you're talking about, I said, and opened the door with 15 seconds to spare.
And if I found Aurelie's face before I stepped aside so Jessie could enter, maybe making Aurelie squirm a little didn't bother me at all. From the front of the room, Adam looked up from his notes. He saw Jessie and smiled at her. His smile widened when he saw me. Like Warren, he looked worn out. I was pretty sure that he hadn't gotten any sleep at all last night. By my count, that's all of us, I told him.
George isn't here, said Elliot, one of the more dominant wolves in the room.
He was a big man, massive, if not as tall as Warren. Like several of the other wolves, he worked for Adam's security company. Ex-military, I knew, but I didn't think his military service had been in the last 100 years. Elliot had bet $1 on Sherwood being Rasputin, the mad monk of Russia, which was ridiculous because there were photos of Rasputin and he didn't look anything like Sherwood, which I had told him at the time. Elliot had grinned at me.
It's the eyes, he'd said. You can tell by the eyes.
Which meant that he was, like several of the others, putting out bets to tease Sherwood. Sherwood, when he'd seen it, had grunted, then said something in Russian. I'm not sure what it had meant, but it had sounded exasperated. Unlike others, I didn't put any stock in Sherwood's prowess in Russian being a clue to who he had been. Adam spoke Russian, and he'd been born in Alabama.
Bran, as far as I could tell, spoke every language on the planet, if sometimes in archaic versions. Living centuries gave a wolf plenty of time to become fluent in any language they wanted to make the effort to learn. New languages would be especially easy for Sherwood to acquire. He wouldn't need a large vocabulary, because he didn't talk a lot.
George couldn't get off work,
Adam told the room. George was a police officer with the Pasco PD. It got him out of a lot of meetings.
He'll be here tonight, and I'll update him.
Warren glanced at a couple of wolves, and they got up, freeing the seats next to Aiden, who rolled his eyes at us.
I don't need a protection detail, said Aiden, pulling his blanket closer around him. I don't think there's anyone here who wants to kill me.
He didn't speak particularly loudly, but everyone in the room heard him just fine. Jessie rolled her eyes back at him. She was better at it.
Just me, she said in syrupy tones.
She continued with sisterly affection as she sat down.
Stupid head, we have to sit next to you. How else am I going to pass notes back and forth? And why are you wrapped in a blanket?
Shh, said Aiden.
I'll tell you later.
Adam had leaned back against the table, legs crossed at the ankles and arms folded.
Anytime you are ready,
he said with faux patience.
Sure, Dad,
Jessie told him, as Warren and I took our seats and the rest of the pack quieted down.
Go right ahead.
He grinned at her cheeky response, showing a dimple. Properly, I suppose, he should have enforced discipline. But our pack was very stable at the moment, forced there by the gigantic task of keeping the peace in our territory. Since I'd made us responsible for the safety of the citizens of the Tri-Cities area, and the Fae had taken it a step further and signed a treaty that established the Tri-Cities as a neutral place, we'd been kept hopping, what with minor actors coming in to test our mettle, and major offenses like the latest one with the zombies. We were too busy to stoop to squabbles. As a result, our pack was a tightly knit bunch. I glanced at Aurieli and amended my thought. As long as Christy quit sticking her fingers into our business, we were a tightly knit bunch. Today, there was a thread of tension in the room that hadn't been there a few weeks ago, or that I hadn't noticed a few weeks ago. Adam took a breath and looked around the room.
I didn't ask you all here on a whim, he said. Yesterday brought us some problems.
He explained yesterday in a concise and cogent manner, beginning with Underhill's addition to the landscaping of the backyard, through Anna's and Dennis's deaths, and ending with the final act of the jackrabbit hunt that left us with the realization that we had an unknown but magically capable foe, probably an escapee from Underhill. I noted that he left out my vampire stalker. I wasn't sure why. I hoped that he wasn't trying to spare me any attacks by Aurieli, who had become very quick to point her finger at me since Christy had re-sunk her claws into the pack. I didn't need him to protect me from Aurieli. She didn't worry me. Made me sad, yes. Worried? No. Of course, he'd left out the werewolves, too, so maybe he was just working his way down the list of our new and newly active opponents, one at a time.
Aiden has some insight as to what we might be facing, Adam said. Since our adversary and the door to Underhill appeared on the same evening, we are making the guarded assumption that one has to do with the other. Aiden?
Aiden stood up and gave the same precy he'd given Adam and me last night. Daryl stood up when Aiden finished. Adam nodded.
What makes you certain that Mercy's jackrabbit and your smoke demon are the same creature?
Daryl asked.
I'm not doubting you, just asking for clarification.
Her wound smoked, Aiden said. I don't know of any other creature that leaves smoking wounds with only a bite. Not in Underhill, at least.
Daryl sat down, and Honey stood up.
Are you certain it is something that escaped from Underhill? Honey asked. There are a lot of magically gifted others who are not werewolf, vampire, or fae. Could one of them have been attracted by all of the notice being paid to us? Maybe its appearance at the same time as the new door is just a coincidence.
Downstairs, the doorbell rang. Jessie said,
Since I'm only here for curiosity's sake, I'll go get it.
Wait.
Adam held up a hand. I gave voice to his thought. It's 5:30 in the morning and someone is ringing the doorbell?
Warren, Adam said, would you go down with Mercy and see who it is?
By traditional accounting, Warren was third in the pack after Adam and Daryl. As Adam's mate, I shared his rank, because women didn't get their own rank, traditionally speaking anyway. Our pack had started to broaden our reality a bit. Pack members could still easily rattle off the ranking of wolves according to tradition, but they treated Honey as if she were ranked in the pack just below Warren, instead of the bottom of the pack ranking, where an unmated female would normally be accounted. Honey blamed me for this, and she might have been right. Sometimes she chafed at it, but more and more she owned that rank. Aurieli, as Daryl's wife, outranked everyone except Adam, me, and Daryl in that order. But the pack had started treating her as if she were right behind Honey, and it felt like a promotion, even though technically she had dropped in rank. Adam told me that he was just holding his breath and hoping that it continued. Werewolves are volatile creatures. It is hard for the human to hold the wolf in check. And when it didn't work, well, there was only one thing to be done with an out-of-control werewolf. And now that the wolves were outed to the human world, there were no second chances. Anything that could be done to strengthen the ties that bound the pack together also helped everyone manage better. Adam maintained that by actually paying attention to the real order of dominance. Our pack members were better adjusted and not nearly so likely to go off on another member of the pack because their wolf was confused about who was actually dominant. To that end, we all pretended that we didn't see what was really going on, and only occasionally did it pop up in conversations. We weren't ignoring it, but we were pretending that nothing had changed. The Maroc's son, Charles, who treated his own wolf spirit as if it were another sentient being who shared his skin, once told me that wolves were straightforward creatures on the whole, and that most of the mess that was werewolf culture had been brought about by the human halves of the werewolves. I was beginning to see what he meant. We also pretended, Adam, Daryl, Warren, and I, that Warren was not more dominant than Daryl. Warren was gay, and a lot of our werewolves had grown up in eras in which that was something not tolerated. The survival rate for gay or lesbian werewolves was far lower than for straight werewolves, which wasn't anything to brag about either. Warren was the only gay werewolf I knew. The bigoted members of our pack had been bludgeoned, literally and figuratively, into first tolerating Warren and then appreciating him. But none of us was sure if that would hold, should Warren become Adam's second, who would be counted upon to lead the pack should something happen to Adam. All of that meant that Adam had just picked out the most dangerous werewolf in the pack besides himself to escort me downstairs. Maybe it was only because Warren had been sitting next to me, but I doubted it. The doorbell rang again as Warren held the door for me and followed me down, as if I outranked him. I stopped in the bedroom to grab my carry gun and tucked it, loaded and ready to go, in the back of my jeans. Warren didn't say anything about it, just patted his lower back. He was carrying too. As we got to the bottom step, doors slammed and a car took off. Honda V6, I told Warren. J-Series, if it mattered. But that didn't tell him any more than it told me. There were a lot of Hondas with a V6 J-Series, and there were different versions of the J-Series. Hondas weren't my manufacturer, so I couldn't tell one version from another without having two different versions in front of me.
Probably not a rental car, said Warren.
Okay, so it told us something. Rental cars tended to be the stripped-down versions, and the V6 was mostly an upgrade. We were both speaking very quietly as we closed in on the door. Warren kept his eyes on the windows where people could look in. It was darker in the house than it was outside now, so it would be hard for someone to see us, but not impossible.
Adam needs to get opaque curtains and use them, said Warren.
Then we can't see out, I told him, not paying as much attention to what I said as to the front door.
I know he has cameras, Warren answered. He doesn't need windows.
He bent down and cautiously looked through the peephole and shook his head. "Maybe it's a Girl Scout," I told him. "They're short."
"There, you've done it," said Warren, reaching for the door. "Now I want a thin mint, and it's the wrong time of the year."
He opened the door quickly, stepping away into the side. But there was no attack. Instead, there was a body on the porch. It took me an instant that felt heart-stoppingly long to realize the body was breathing. Warren leaned his head down, took a good scent, and then leaped across the porch and started running down the road as fast as he could, which was impressively fast, even in human form. I was pretty sure that we were too late for catching the people who'd driven off, unless they had parked and come back to see what we did, which was possible. I checked out the man on our porch. I smelled unfamiliar werewolves, but I didn't smell any blood. He appeared undamaged, except for the part about him being unconscious. Good. Because I liked him. "Mary Jo," I called out. "You want to come down? It's Rennie." The gift our werewolf invaders had left for us was Deputy Alexander Renton of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. He was in uniform, so presumably they'd abducted him while he was on patrol. Wolves in human form boiled down the stairs and out to the porch. Daryl and Aurieli did the same sniff and go that Warren had done. Mary Jo dropped to her knees beside him. "Damn it, Rennie," she muttered to the unconscious man as she peeled back his eyelids to check his eyes. "I told you it wasn't a good idea for us to start dating again." She checked his pulse, then looked up at Adam. "I think he's fine. His heart rate is normal. His color's good. They hit him with a trank of some sort, I think. His department is going to be in the middle of a mad hunt for him. We should call them." That last was a request for permission.
"Do it," said Adam.
Narrow-eyed, he looked out at our surroundings, pausing at a small boat on the far side of the river, maybe a quarter of a mile away.
"That boat has binoculars pointed at us," he said in a conversational tone.
Virtually as one, the pack glanced at him to see where he was looking, then followed his gaze out to the river. They were intent enough that the pack magic rose among us, and we, the pack, understood that there was no chance of getting to the boat before they fled, because Adam knew that. We also rejected using the handguns that some of us were carrying, because it was too far for a clean shot, and besides, we weren't sure Adam wanted them dead. The boat's engine got louder as the boat swung around and took its passengers upriver and out of our sight. The pack hunting magic subsided.
"We could intercept," suggested Ben, who did some boating with friends from work. "That small engine is good for being quiet, but pushing even that little boat upriver will be slow going."
Adam shook his head.
"I don't want them yet," he said.
"I take it," said Honey, brushing her honey-colored hair out of her eyes, "that the wolves who did this were another of the interesting discoveries you made last night."
"Because by St. Peter's Peter," said Ben, "an arse-licking boogeyman wasn't enough. We needed a bishop-beating bunch of mangy-invading werewolves, too."
Luke laughed, and in a fake British accent said,
"Fecking right, Ben, my lad, but it would take a real gobshite to try to invade us right this moment."
"Agreed,"
said Honey, while I was still trying to figure out what a gobshite was.
"They should wait a few more months until attrition has winnowed our numbers down sufficiently."
A silence followed her words, broken only by Mary Jo's quiet voice as she talked to the sheriff's department. It was true. Since we weren't connected with the rest of the packs, for various political and doubtless correct reasons, in the Americas, when our wolves left, there were no replacements. We'd lost 8 wolves since we'd broken with the Maroc. One of us had died, and the other 7 had moved for the usual reasons: better jobs, family necessity, and the war-ready tension our pack had to operate under right now. Adam could have made them stay, but he refused to do that. Our pack, which used to have between 30 and 40 people in it, was down to 26. Our wolves had given up on the chase and were jogging back to the house.
"They want to talk to you," said Mary Jo, handing her phone over to Adam. "I'll take him inside." Put him in the spare bedroom, I told her, as Adam explained that he understood that the sheriff's office was not happy with one of their people being taken. The sheets on the bed are clean. She picked him up in a fireman's carry. He was quite a bit taller and more massive than she was, so it looked a little odd.
I'll get the doors, volunteered Ben.
It took Adam about 10 minutes to negotiate a path forward with Rennie's sheriff that didn't involve the sheriff's department taking the town apart to look for the perpetrators. The chill effect of Honey's words kept the rest of the pack quiet. Adam and I had talked about our declining numbers, but apparently it was a new thought for most of the pack. Or maybe hearing it said out loud made it harder to ignore. Arielle, Daryl, and Warren were jogging up to the porch by the time Adam disconnected.
Let's go back upstairs, Adam said. I have some information for you about the wolves who dropped Deputy Renton on our porch.
Once everyone was seated again, including Mary Jo and Ben, who'd returned from settling Rennie, who appeared to be sleeping comfortably, Adam ran down the details of the wolf kill the night before.
I identified two of the werewolves from last night, and I made some calls, Adam said. I have a pretty good idea who the leader of this pack is.
He let that sink in a moment, then continued.
And we can put some other names in the probable category. I don't think it's a big group. More than likely, there are only 6 of them. Warren, could you get the lights?
Warren reached over his shoulder and flipped the light switch. Adam pulled down the shades and turned on the projector. A somewhat grainy photograph of the top quarter of a man appeared on the screen. He had a narrow, aquiline face, a long nose, and big, dark eyes.
Harrelford, said Elliot as soon as the photo came up. He didn't sound happy. The big man growled. Bastard. Nasty opponent in a one-on-one fight. Wipe the floor with me.
Elliot looked at Adam.
That was before I came here, and I'm a better fighter now. But I don't have any appetite to go at it again with him. He's a good strategist, thinks a few steps ahead. I don't like him at all, but he isn't stupid.
Adam looked around the room.
I haven't met him, Adam said. Does anyone else know anything about him?
Maybe, said Arielle. I don't know him. But if that is Sven Harrelford,
it is,
said Adam. Then I've had 2 women, werewolves both, who told me never to be alone with him, she said. Then she smiled, a dark and hungry smile, which makes me want very much to do exactly that. There was a short silence.
Don't remember him, said Sherwood, but my wolf is pretty unhappy about him. I'd be okay with killing him.
When no one else said anything, Adam pulled up another face. No one knew that one.
He has been going by the name Lincoln Stewart, though he is old, and that is not his original name.
Was he the guy who was second to, Mary Jo snapped her fingers impatiently, a pack in Nebraska, but I can't think of the alpha's name.
I know who you mean, Adam said. And no, you're thinking about Lincoln Thorson. He's still second in the Lincoln Nebraska pack, which is why everyone remembers him. This isn't that Lincoln.
He brought up another photo. This one was a kind of photo taken on vacations. An Asian man and woman were standing in front of what I was pretty sure was the Grand Canyon. The shot looked as though it had been taken 30 years ago. The man was smiling at the woman, who was pointing at him with both of her index fingers in a look-what-I-caught pose that was completed by her over-the-moon smile.
Chen Li Chang.
Carlos was not a big man. Nor did he look like the badass he was. He worked for Adam, and his specialty, I knew, was de-escalating FUBAR situations.
Damn it, Adam, Carlos said with feeling. Damn it. Li Chang, he's a friend. I served with him in Korea. His name is Chinese, said Daryl, and he looks Chinese. He is, said Carlos, but he's lived in the States since he came over to work on the railroad and ran into a werewolf. He worked as a translator for the USMC because his Korean is almost as good as his Cantonese and Mandarin.
Carlos rubbed his hands together and shook his head.
That girl in the photo was his wife. She died about 5 years ago. I went to the funeral. I remember, said Adam. I haven't seen him since, Carlos admitted. I heard he didn't adjust to his wife's death well, and he left his pack.
Honey knew the next one, a soft-faced man with gray eyes and medium brown hair.
"That's Kent Schwabe," she said, sorrow in her voice. "He was a good man, Adam. Ended up in a bad pack, though. I think in Florida. Charles killed that alpha back in the 1960s, and the whole pack was dismantled. We were casual acquaintances, though, so I don't know what happened to Kent after that."
"He moved to Texas," Adam told her. "He ended up in Galveston."
"That's Gartman's pack," said Warren, sitting up a little straighter.
It hadn't been a question, but Adam nodded.
"That's right."
Warren growled. "Some damn fool should take that alpha right out of existence. World would be a better place."
Adam tipped his head toward Warren.
"Oh?
I expect you've heard people say he keeps a peace, that his wolves don't cause no trouble and they never say a bad word about him," said Warren. "I know, because I talked to Bran about that one a few times. Bran is watching him, but he can't do anything until he gets a complaint or something happens."
Adam said carefully,
"I understand that he's a hard man."
"Hell," Warren said, "I don't mind a hard man."
"I've heard that," said Ben, his British accent carrying through the room. Warren gave him a roguish look. He and Ben were friends.
"Kyle aside," Warren said, and there were a few soft laughs from the pack. "Gartman's not hard, Adam. He's polecat mean. Some of his pack stay with him because they like that. He allows them to be mean, too. Most of them are too afraid to squeak."
"Good to know," Adam said. "I hadn't heard anything bad about him until last night."
He changed the photo again. This time it was a thin-faced woman in profile. No one knew her.
"This is Nani Palsik. She's old. My informant."
"Charles," I thought. Though officially Charles shouldn't be giving us information since we weren't affiliated with the Maroc. I'm sure the Maroc told Charles that too, knowing exactly how well his son would follow that directive.
"Tells me that she's around 400 years old. She's mated to this man."
He changed the screen to show an ordinary-looking guy with a baseball in one hand and a bat over his shoulder. Adam looked over the room, and when no one spoke up, he announced,
"This is James Palsik. He is older than his mate, possibly a lot older than his mate. I met James about 20 years ago.
So did any of you who were in my pack when we were in Los Alamos. He was an engineer on assignment. Worked at the National Lab down there for 2 months before he went back to Washington, D.C.
When no one said anything, Adam smiled.
"I have noticed that people don't tend to remember him. I've been told that it's not magic. Not sure I believe it. It is true that he is very low-key. He was one of the wolves I scented last night. Li Chiang was the other."
"I didn't know that you knew Li Chiang," said Carlos.
"I've never met him," Adam told him. "But I picked you up at the airport when you came back from the funeral."
Carlos flushed and looked away.
"Hey,"
said Adam. When Carlos looked at him, Adam told him,
"Not anyone's business."
The words and the tone had a bite to them, were a reproof. But Carlos relaxed, gave a nod, and settled back in his seat.
"All right,"
he said.
"About 6 months ago," Adam continued, "there was a disturbance in Gartman's pack. By the time Bran found out about it, it was over. Gartman had executed four wolves, and Harrowford and a few of the remaining rebels were on the run. No sign of them since then, though Bran and Gartman have both been looking."
"Those six you just showed us," said Warren.
"Yes,"
Adam agreed.
"I've also heard of Gartman,"
said Daryl, his voice so deep that if Gartman had been in the room, he'd better have hoped he could run faster than our second.
"Harrowford and the others, they are in trouble, and they have to find somewhere out of Gartman's reach. Our pack, not affiliated with the Maroc, might look like a good place to make a stand, if they can take us."
"They hunted on our territory until you noticed," Honey said, "to see how alert we are."
"No telling how long they've been in the Tri-Cities," Elliot said.
I cleared my throat. "The goblins keep a pretty thorough watch. Unless they have someone with Adam's skills, if they had been here long, we'd have known about it." We paid the goblins to keep watch for us, as did the vampires, There just weren't enough werewolves to cover the whole of the Tri-Cities and the surrounding areas. I didn't have any idea how many goblins there were, but if a supernaturally gifted being stepped foot on our territory, mostly we knew about it within a few hours.
Maybe they paid off the goblins, said Arielle.
I was about to disagree when Adam said,
Or maybe they are owed a favor. The goblins wouldn't betray us for money. But all of the Fae have to abide by the bargains they make. These wolves have done a couple of things that make me think they've been watching us a while, or that maybe they have a way to get information on us that doesn't involve them being here.
Rennie? Asked Mary Jo. Adam nodded.
That's one. How would they know about Rennie without being here?
Jessie stood up. Adam nodded at her.
Facebook, she said. Mary Jo posted a photo of their last date together.
She sat down triumphantly. Mary Jo slumped lower in her seat, but she nodded when she did.
Facebook,
said Adam, sounding blindsided. Daryl stood up.
It would be a good idea for the pack members who are out to avoid having a social media presence. Make it so,
Adam said as Daryl sat down.
Too many people know who you are, and that makes your friends and families targets. To those who want to take the pack from us, said Daryl heavily, his dark eyes flecked with gold.
Adam smiled, and for the first time in weeks it was a happy smile. Though nothing could erase the exhaustion on his face, that expression lit his face and sweetened the beautiful features.
Yes,
he agreed. Chapter 5.
Is there a reason we're happy about this, boss?
Asked Warren warily. I happened to be watching Sherwood and saw him grin in sudden comprehension. He knew what Adam was doing. Adam nodded in answer to Warren's question.
I think so. I'm going to conscript them if I can. We need more bodies. They need a place to be safe. It might take some negotiation.
Arielle looked at Adam, and there was just a hint of a sneer on her mouth when she said,
Try to take them before they take the pack from you.
Beside her, Daryl stiffened. The smile melted from Adam's face and his eyes grew cold.
Make no mistake, Arielle. They cannot take this pack from me.
He stared at her a moment until she dropped her eyes. It was not voluntary, that averting of Arielle's eyes. I could see it in the stiffness of her shoulders.
What the hell, Arielle?
Said Daryl in a voice that I don't think he intended to carry. She shot him a venomous look.
Arielle, said Adam in a soft, dangerous voice. Do you want to challenge me for the pack?
She shot to her feet.
Daryl.
Daryl is welcome to make his own decisions,
Adam told her without looking at Daryl, who was shaking his head vehemently.
No, said Daryl, absolutely not.
Obviously, he didn't want Adam, or maybe Arielle, who was also not looking at her mate, to be under any misapprehension of his intentions.
Arielle, said Adam. Go to my office and wait for me there.
I was pretty unhappy with Arielle at that point, but that didn't stop the hackles rising on the back of my neck at his tone of voice. Arielle was a strong member of the pack, and I didn't like her being talked to like she was a misbehaving 12-year-old. It brought up shadows in my memory of just such pronouncements from the Morak. But I was not a werewolf, and not caught up in the need for pack and order that the werewolves were. I knew that the argument she wanted was something that Adam could not tolerate here with the whole pack in attendance. If he didn't stop her right now, she might force him to do something that he didn't want to do. The wolves were all of them dangerous, to other members of the pack, to the community, and to themselves. A wolf without boundaries killed people that their human halves would not want killed. Arielle knew how far she could push the rules of the pack. And she was pushing beyond them. That wasn't safe for her or the people around her. Still, it struck me that Arielle and Adam were both acting a little out of character. I looked around the room and felt the tension in the air. But there had been something hovering in the meeting room since I'd first come in, before the Rennie incident even. and I wondered if Adam was locking down the bond between the two of us because he didn't want to damage, pollute, scare me, or whatever excuse he was using. What had been happening with the pack bonds? He couldn't shut those down. So what was he doing? And how was it affecting the pack? Arielle hesitated for a heartbeat, then wrapped herself in righteous fury that I was not wholly unsympathetic with, given Adam's tone of voice, before she headed out the door. I wondered how much of her over-the-top behavior had been pushed on her by the pack bonds she shared with Adam. I'd had a few members of the pack make me act stupidly before. They had been doing it on purpose, but I knew that it could happen. For that matter, I wondered if Adam's patronizing tone came from the same source that had made him act weird yesterday. Adam watched her leave, then looked at Daryl.
"I would like to bring you into that conversation, too," he told Daryl. "My maid is passionate in defense of those she loves," Daryl growled defensively.
Yes, but she wasn't stupid, I thought, sitting back. Yesterday and today, she had been acting entirely out of character. Something else besides Christy was going on. Something maybe like Adam's struggles and the pack bonds.
"Her loyalty is one of her best qualities," Adam told Daryl sincerely, though he was quite aware that the rest of the pack were listening. "And so is her intelligence. So when I'm done here, we are going to sit down with her and figure out what is interfering with her usual good sense. It isn't that she suddenly decided she needs to take over the pack. If Arielle wanted this pack, I'd figure that out a few months after I'd agreed to take a 20-year sabbatical in the Yucatan Peninsula and left y'all in her tender and competent care."
The stress level in the room resolved into a wry wave of amused agreement. Daryl kept a game face on. I couldn't tell if he knew what was bothering Arielle or not. Adam, I thought, would know about what the pack bonds could do better than I did. He'd do his best to keep the pack safe and stable. But for how long? Adam swept his gaze over the room again, and I saw how tired he looked, saw the weight on his shoulders, and I was the only one in the room who knew that there was a reason that had nothing to do with no sleep. Arielle's dramatic moment, mind-bending escapees from Underhill, or invading werewolves. That meant that I was going to have to be the one who helped him out.
"So," said Adam, "we have an invasion commencing and something of mostly unknown capabilities out creating havoc. Be careful out there. Watch your backs. Tell your families what's going on and tell them to keep an eye out. Don't hesitate to contact me if you think something is wrong. If you want to bring your families here to stay until matters clear up, we can do that." "That they hit Mary Jo's boyfriend."
"Of 2 weeks," said Mary Jo.
"Of 2 weeks," agreed Adam. "Implies that they are watching us. They have spent some time studying how we function."
"What do you plan to do?" asked Elliot.
Adam smiled.
"At its heart, taking over a pack is simple. Kill the alpha in a challenge. I plan on not dying. Go home."
He waved his hand. There was a rumble of laughter as the mass exodus took place. Daryl wasn't laughing. He stayed in his chair and stretched out his legs, his arms folded across his chest. Adam caught my eye and nodded for me to stay where I was. Warren gathered Jesse and Aiden and exited with the rest. When everyone was gone, I shut the door. Daryl glanced around to make sure the door was closed, then looked at Adam.
"I don't know what it is either. She's been upset. You know, the kind of upset that when I ask about it, I get the nothing is wrong answer."
He grimaced at Adam.
"Which is highly irritating when she knows that I can tell she's lying. But telling her that, something she already knows, will only give her an excuse to blow up at me, and she is looking for excuses to blow up."
At least I thought Adam isn't giving me that nothing is wrong answer anymore. I wasn't entirely sure that it was an improvement. If he'd been lying to me, I could be mad at him. That might feel better than this lump in my throat.
"Let's go see what we can do for her," Adam said.
"Why am I here?" I asked him. "You don't need me for this. She doesn't even like me."
"Sure she does," said Daryl unexpectedly. "Why do you think she's so mad at you about Christy?"
That makes sense how? I asked, flummoxed.
As much sense as lying to your mate who is a werewolf,
Daryl answered.
She is smart, passionate, and loyal. In situations that draw on all three of those, logic flies out the window.
Agreed, I said. But that doesn't tell me why you need me to come.
I don't know about him,
Daryl said.
But I'm hoping she'll be so focused on you that she'll forget to be mad at me. I want to be able to sleep tonight without having to keep one eye open.
Thanks, I said dryly. Happy to help. Adam's office was not large enough for four people to fit comfortably. That was even more evident when three of them were dominant werewolves. Adam sat in the chair behind his desk. Arielle occupied the other chair, a leather and maple work of art that Christy had given Adam for their anniversary one year. That left Daryl holding up a wall and me sitting on Adam's desk. Arielle was sitting as though she were modeling for a portrait. She was that still. She held her body like a dancer just before the music starts, back upright and body tense. Her legs were tucked back, ready to push her to her feet at any time. She had barely acknowledged any of us. Adam pursed his lips.
So how do you think Harrelford, always assuming he is the one in charge, will work his attack? Slow and steady or blitzkrieg with all barrels firing?
Arielle finally looked up.
Are you asking me?
Her tone was incredulous. Adam looked at Daryl, who was keeping his face neutral, and then me before looking at Arielle. His face was slightly amused.
Yes.
She glared at him. He raised an eyebrow.
I thought we were going to talk about my behavior, she said, her voice a growl.
Adam tilted his head.
Why? You know what you did today was stupid. We know that there is something behind it that's a lot more traumatic than my ex-wife's disappointment about Jesse's choice of schools. I'm not going to ask you about it. Just inform you that...
His voice dropped low and softened dangerously as his eyes turned yellow.
You need to stop letting it affect you to the point where you are useless to the pack.
She met his eyes for a long moment before water gathered on her lower lids. I twisted around and opened a drawer in Adam's desk to grab a tissue. When I turned around, Daryl was kneeling beside her, one of his big arms wrapped around her. To accommodate his hold, she had slid to the very edge of the chair. I handed her the tissue. She grabbed it and wiped her eyes.
Damn it, she muttered. I'm sorry, Mercy. I should have talked to you before I acted. I know that Christy isn't logical about you.
I made a humming noise. It's probably the blue hair dye that I may or may not have put in the shampoo container she left in my shower, I told her. I wouldn't like me either if I were her. Her lips turned up, and she gave a half laugh.
Yes, Mercy. I'm sure that the blue dye is the real reason that Christy doesn't like you.
She looked at Adam.
I'm sorry. I had some family news a few days ago.
She drew in a breath, and when she spoke again, she was talking to Daryl.
My youngest sister is pregnant with twins.
The silence that followed was full of sharp edges. Arielle and Daryl had no children. Male werewolves could father children, but female werewolves could not carry them. The moon's call ensured that all werewolves had to change. The change from human to wolf is violent, too violent for a fetus to survive the first trimester. Arielle's youngest sister was not a werewolf.
Surrogate, said Daryl, his voice decisive.
Who would be a surrogate for a werewolf? Arielle shot back. The speed of her response told me that this was an old argument.
Someone who wanted to become a werewolf anyway, answered Adam. Let me speak to Bran.
They both blinked at Adam, as if it had not occurred to them.
I don't know that there is such a woman, he continued. And even if we can locate one, it might be hard to find a reproductive specialist willing to work with our situation.
And if you find someone like that, said Arielle, there will be a long line of werewolves who want children, and our pack is not affiliated with the Maroc anymore.
Adam shrugged.
You have time, as long as you don't force me to kill you or Daryl in the meantime. So don't start that fight, mi vida, said Daryl.
She laughed, though it sounded shaky.
I'll keep that in mind.
She rubbed her hands together, rolling the damp tissue into a ball. She leaned a little harder into Daryl and said,
Blitzkrieg, there is no other way for them to succeed. This is our territory and we have resources here. They need to make you look weak, make the pack feel unprotected. So they have to hit us hard and heavy. Mary Jo's bow won't be the only family member hit.
He wasn't hurt, I said.
First salvo, said Daryl.
They are telling our pack, look at us. We can take yours and return him unharmed because we are just that powerful.
I agree, said Adam. None of our vulnerable is safe.
Should we call them into the pack house? I asked. Aurieli shook her head.
No, not yet. We have to trust our people. Adam's been instilling fighting skills in all of us, willing or not, way before Daryl or I joined the pack. We can protect our own. If someone needs support, then they can call for help.
How about assigning some of the single wolves to help keep watch over the families, I suggested.
I'll get that done, said Daryl.
Okay, said Adam, checking his watch. If you leave now, Aurieli won't be late for work.
They left and shut the door behind them. I turned around on the desk until I was facing Adam. I took a moment and just looked at him, seeing the stress of whatever was bothering him, the cost of the sleepless nights, and the toll that came with being the alpha of the pack. I'd been toying with an idea that might help him, and looking at his careworn face gave me the hit of courage I needed. I slid off the desk on Adam's side and grabbed his hand. He grabbed my hand in return, just a little tighter than he normally would have. I leaned back and hauled him out of his chair. He didn't resist, so I didn't have to pull too hard.
Come on, I said grimly. Come where?
He asked. I have something you need to see. I kept his hand in mine as I went back upstairs, ignoring the sounds of lingering pack members from the kitchen and living room.
What is it?
Adam asked me. I shook my head. Wait. I took him into our bedroom and closed the door, letting go of his hand as I did so. I leaned an ear against the door.
What are you doing?
He asked. He moved farther into the room, rubbing his neck tiredly.
Making sure that there isn't anyone to overhear, I whispered.
He gave me a frown.
There isn't anyone upstairs, Mercy. You and I can both tell that. What is this all about?
I turned back to him. For what I'm going to reveal to you, I said seriously, I want to be absolutely sure that we are alone. He hadn't had a good night's sleep in weeks. He'd been stressed and exhausted before all hell had broken loose yesterday. Something needed to give before the invading werewolf pack was the least of our worries. I pulled down the roller shades over the windows, explaining, I don't want my stalker to see or hear anything either.
It's daytime, he said.
I don't trust daytime to stop a wolf, I said, half seriously, and I don't want him to see this. He made a growling noise.
Mercy.
I pulled my shirt over my head and dropped it on the floor. Unhooking my bra, I shrugged it off too. Adam went silent.
I told you I had something to show you,
I murmured in what I hoped was a sexy purr. I was not sexually brave, had not been even before my assault a while back. Without Adam, it was not unimaginable that I would never have opened up enough after that to even take a lover, let alone a mate. But resisting Adam was never in my cards. This morning, I hoped he felt the same way. He didn't say anything, nor could I read the expression on his face. Maybe he was suppressing what he felt, or maybe with the shades drawn to darken the room and his head bent to put his eyes even deeper into the shadows, I just couldn't see him well enough to interpret his expression. My heart was in my mouth, and I was too... Frightened was not quite the right word, but it was fear that kept my breathing shallow. Fear of rejection. Fear that whatever had him all but strangling our mating bond would stop him from taking up my invitation, and what that would mean about our relationship going forward from this moment. So maybe frightened was exactly the right word. Without a reaction from him, I had two choices. First, I could grab my clothes and tell him I had to go to work. And it wouldn't be a lie, even though I had texted Tad during the meeting that I would not be in today until after lunch, along with a warning to watch his back because there were some interesting things happening. My business didn't need me to go into work this morning, but I would need a place to lick my wounds, and the garage would do. If I lost my nerve here, I had a place to run. My second choice was to keep braving on and trust Adam not to leave me hanging out on a limb. My fingers numb with terror, I unzipped my jeans. I didn't say anything, because I was afraid that my voice would tell him that it wasn't desire I was feeling, though while hauling him up the stairs, my skin had been hot with anticipation. I was risking my marriage. Men couldn't fake desire the way a woman could. Not that I could, and certainly no woman with a werewolf for a lover could fake it for long. But a man's desire was obvious and unmistakable. There were a dozen reasons floating around in my head, in my heart, for why Adam might not be interested. There were werewolves invading our territory. There was whatever had him putting up barriers between us. There was the fact that he hadn't had a full night's sleep in however long. It was daytime, and he should be getting ready for work. And if he rejected me, however gently he did it, I would never find the courage to open up like this to him again. There were tears gathering in my eyes at the thought of losing us, losing what we were. But I felt that it would say something equally bad about our relationship if I didn't take this risk. So I tipped my head down and blinked hard as I slid my jeans and, the hell with it, switched my grip so my panties slid off my hips at the same time. I couldn't look at him as the cloth puddled on the carpet. I could barely breathe. I knew it was a balmy 68 degrees in the room, but I felt like I was in an ice cave. Naked, I stepped away from my clothes and then stopped, forcing my hands to remain at my sides and not move to protect my bareness from his sight. Adam had seen me naked before, but I don't think I'd ever felt more vulnerable, because this wasn't about being naked in flesh. It was about risking myself to help him. Help us. Possible disastrous storylines ran in my head as I stood there. I imagined him expressing his sadness that I had put him on the spot. I heard him tell me that this wasn't the time for such a thing, that he'd made it clear that sex was off the table until he'd figured out whatever naughty problem his head was all tangled up in. Rapidly, I conjured up failure, and imagining that was nearly as traumatic as the real thing might be. I was seriously considering throwing up when warm hands closed over my shoulders and Adam's face pressed against my neck.
"Fucking hell,"
Adam said about the same time I realized that my neck